Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. This is your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim O'Shea. Happy to be joining you once again.
Tim, great to see you. Well, you know, you brought in an interesting guest.
Well,
today.
Did I bring him, or who did he drive in with? We'll start with that. John, we're thrilled to have Jake Simperman today, a guy you know pretty well. For everyone out there, Jake is a documentary filmmaker based out of Los Angeles, and he also happens to be John's son. And I told John a while back, I want Jake on the show, and you said
that would be great. I'm just not going to be part of the interview.
It's probably cool. I would imagine for you to sit and listen to a conversation like this.
Super proud, obviously, and I know you guys are going to have a real interesting conversation.
Well, he does fascinating work. And, you know, for everybody out there, you can check out Jake Simperman's work. Go find him online and you'll see it. But pro beach hockey is going to be the subject of our conversation today. Jake spent most of the last 5 years of his life working on a full-length feature film, Pro Beach Hockey, Sun, Surf, and Slap Shots. On a personal level, it combines a few things I love: beaches, surfing. I'm not good at it, but I love it. Love trying it. Hockey and roller hockey, which you never hear about anymore.
Yeah, you know, we lived out there in the late 90s. Roller hockey, beach roller hockey international. I mean, that sport was on a roll. And I think as you talk to Jake a little bit, I mean, people always, you know, remember, oh, was that the game with the ramps? Yes, it was. And it was on ESPN for 3 years. The story about, you know, what happened to roller hockey, inline hockey as a sport, and then what happened to that league in particular, you and Jake will get into.
I was just so curious because we had it was there, and we had it out here in the East as well. Buffalo had a pro roller hockey team, not a beach roller hockey team, not one with ramps, but just an indoor arena hockey, roller hockey league team. Many, or if not most, of the big league cities out here in the East had that, and that just kind of went away too. And so, it's interesting to hear what happened and how it ties into the consumer marketplace, which really is a big piece of the story.
Yeah, it's a shame. And what I saw with inline hockey out in LA was that was the gateway to get sticks in hands. That was the opportunity, a super approachable opportunity to get young folks into the game from all different backgrounds, because you didn't need to spend hundreds of dollars on equipment. You needed a parking lot. You needed a stick and a pair of rollerblades, which were ubiquitous back then.
John, you got me thinking here about sports or sports activities that were popular and don't seem to be anymore. So I'll throw inline skating out there, of course. What else comes to mind for you?
Boy, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this craze going on with the sport of pickleball, right? But what happened to racquetball? Racquetball clubs were everywhere. They were social places. Some of them had restaurants and bars tied to them. So, racquetball, I would put that into the rest in peace category of participation sports.
Yeah, you rarely hear about that anymore. I mean, do you have a sense of why? I mean, did pickleball overtake racquetball, or
I don't know. We're going to have a full Skin in the Game episode on racquet sports, right? You know, squash, platform tennis, which is another great sport you don't see as much as you used to. But racquetball, especially in the 80s, was like the thing to do. But I don't know if there's many racquetball courts or players left.
One that went away and came back is skateboarding.
Yes, it did. It sure did. It sure did. It's made a comeback. The other sports, you know, and I know an episode or so back with SL Price, we talked a lot about the American game and lacrosse. You know, there's actually in the last couple of years been a decline in participation of lacrosse. And that's the first time in years, because, you know, for 10, 15 years, lacrosse had some of the biggest growth numbers. So I'm not putting lacrosse at all in that category of racquetball, but it's just something to keep an eye out for. And it'll be interesting to see if they can reverse that trend.
Well, some of these things are seasonal, too. And we got into this in the episode with SL Price. You've got the NFL putting enormous resources behind the sport of flag football, which can be and is played year-round, but at the scholastic level, it tends to be a spring sport that overlaps with softball. that overlaps with lacrosse. It also overlaps with track and field.
Right.
And so now you've got these different youth oriented sports competing with each other.
Yeah. Well, if we can just get more kids participating in all sports, you know, I think everything will rise and participation will continue to grow.
Even if you're shifting kids a little bit from one sport to another, I would imagine there's a net gain. There are probably more kids involved in sports. I know some myself on the flag football side who, you know, if flag football wasn't a thing, they may not be out on a field of any kind right now.
Right, right. Hey, a couple of news items before we get to your guest on this program. We talk a lot on Skin in the Game about food concessions and the, you know, evolution of a major league experience. What I thought was interesting is the concessionaires at Fenway Park recently went on strike during a big homestand against the LA Dodgers.
Which is a great way to get their point across, right? What did you make of that? Have you seen something like that before in all your years in pro sports?
Yeah, I have not. And digging into the story, you know, obviously better work conditions, better pay are issues. But the big issue, Tim, is automation. You know, they're really want to minimize the effect of a lot of these self-help kiosks, right? Because those kiosks, you know, the quick grab and goes are in some cases taking away the jobs in the ballpark.
You know, in one way, I'm thinking here about the fan experience. It is nice to be able to walk in, grab something and go. There's part of me, though, too, that, you know, where I was thinking, is the food is fresh? You know, because the food's sitting there. And I don't know the answers to this. I'm just telling you what was going through my mind. When somebody's handing you food, you feel like it was just prepared. That doesn't mean it was.
Right.
But you feel it.
Right.
Like you feel like somebody is serving you. You're buying, you know, food and service with it.
You talk about fan experience. Some of the best characters are those vendors who are serving you the beer, the popcorn. You know, they could be entertainment in themselves. So, you know, you don't want to lose the characters. You want to keep that vibe in the ballpark or in the arena. But at the same time, you know, having that convenience for some fans is probably a better option. But for others, they want that personal contact.
Do you think this is a sport-to-sport thing, too? Baseball, love it. But it's a much easier sport to step away from for 15 minutes if you're going to stand in line, as opposed to football or hockey or basketball,
right,
where for a number of reasons, but mainly the pace of the action.
Right.
You don't want to miss much.
Well, it's some, you know, you go to a hockey game and there's reasons that you don't walk down the aisle during live action because you may miss the only goal, right? So some games like baseball are a little bit more casual, shall we say.
Fans probably bond with the vendors more at a baseball game, certainly a minor league baseball game, and I dare say a major league baseball game, than they do at hockey, basketball, or football, for exactly the reasons you're saying. Your eyes are trained on that field.
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, changing gears, although still talking baseball, there's a big Little League tournament in the Carolinas, ages 16 to 18, so it's a step up from the Little League World Series. A team from Venezuela was denied entry into the U.S., there was no ability for them to play and compete. This is a real big deal because in another year, soccer's marquee event is coming to the United States and Canada, that being the World Cup. So it's going to be interesting how these clubs traveling from across the globe are able to enter the United States.
And in 3 years, we'll throw this one out there, the Olympics in Los Angeles.
Right.
I'm not seeing anything that makes me think this situation's going to get easier. It's so frustrating, and it is absolutely a case of global politics impacting not only something like the Olympics, and there's a long precedent for that. It goes back over the, you know, many, many decades, right? But also youth sports. This is where you have to sit back and say, where is the line? And there, you know, there are people out there, there are government officials who have the ability to make exceptions. We've talked about that with SL Price, you know, came to an indigenous lacrosse team being denied entry into, you know, a world tournament, right?
Yeah, and for a lot of these kids, this is an opportunity to showcase their talents. This is an opportunity for quite a few of them. I mean, Venezuela has a strong presence in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was their chance to show their skills to agents and ball clubs, you name it. So it's a big lost opportunity for them. I think if you follow Skin in the Game, we've been waiting for this first kind of the shoe to drop. And this Little League team prohibited coming into the States was, I think, the first shoe to drop.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's likely to be more to come. I mean, here's hoping there's some way to turn that around a little bit. But what it is,
right?
Yeah, I'm shrugging right now. I'm not sure.
So let's flip this to something a little bit more entertaining. You're going to talk about sun and surf and slap shots.
With your son, Jake Simperman. Okay, last chance, John. You want to join in on this conversation or you want to be the first listener?
I'm going to be listening and enjoy yourself.
All right, everybody. So we're going to have John on the other side of the control booth. And I'll be back on Skin in the Game with Jake Simperman. That's coming up next.
I'm excited to see, like, she said this, well, he said that.
The truth will come out.
Wondering what the buzz is? What's the hot goss? Whatever it is, we're talking about it on Group Chat, your weekly connection to the unpredictable, weird, and wonderful world of pop culture. From film, music, theater to food, blockbusters, and beyond. Every week with Tiffany Bentley and her revolving panel of pop culture enthusiasts. Listen to Group Chat on Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at noon on BTPM NPR.
I'm very excited.
Welcome back to Skin in the Game, and I'm sitting here with a different Simperman across the across the booth from me. Jake Simperman, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, and yeah, I think we got to address the elephant in the room right away.
Yeah, your dad just ran out.
Yeah, it is a little weird being on my dad's podcast.
You, Jake, I mean, you've built a career in two things I'm really interested in, and I know I'm far from the only one, which is Hollywood or the entertainment business. And sports. And those two things obviously go together. But you're living that right now. I can introduce you one way. We have here from Los Angeles, Jake Simperman, Hollywood filmmaker with a specialty in sports. And that sounds really glamorous. And I'm sure there's parts that are. And I'm sure there's plenty that's quite the opposite of that. So you are a filmmaker focused on sports. What is that actually like?
Yeah, I mean, I think just trying to, in the most broad sense, just trying to tell stories in the sports world that are, you know, adjacent to the sports, more about culture, players, and things that are happening off the field. That's kind of always been what I've been best at. So things that are really adjacent to the game. And, you know, that's in my career has taken a different sort of form since I started more on sort of the league and team side at Major League Baseball. And now it's, yeah, just about trying to find a lot of these uncovered stories in sports. And that's what, you know, I think the last 4 years of my life have been dedicated to.
Yeah, I've always thought sports is this incredible platform for a broad canvas of storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, in the last couple of weeks, we had the longtime Sports Illustrated writer, S.L. Price, on the show. You know, he was saying that, like, take the platform of sports and, you know, the obvious connection here on this show is business, but you're getting into culture. It's a lens in everything.
Yeah. I mean, sports can be the hook, but there's always more like nuanced issues and nuanced themes that we can tell through, you know, the lens of the game for sure.
So let me start by throwing a specific example out there and let's dig into it. And then we'll go back in time to when you worked with Major League Baseball and recreate how you got here today. But later tonight, you and I are, and your dad and a bunch of other people are going to a screening for your film, Pro Beach Hockey, Sun, Surf, and Slap Shots. And I got to tell you, when I've told folks that, hey, you know, I'm talking to Jake Simperman and, oh, what's he done? And I said, well, you know, he's got a film out right now that focuses not only on roller hockey, but roller hockey played on a beach. And people are like, that happened? What?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that. Tell us a little about the film.
Yeah, so, and I guess I got to take you back to literally the 90s when this all occurred. And my dad, we lived in Los Angeles, and my dad would take me to these professional roller hockey games that were on the beach. You know, roller hockey was really, really big in the late 90s, especially in Southern California. And then by the early 2000s, kind of disappeared from pop culture. And I think a lot of people were wondering what happened to it. And I certainly was left with kind of these foggy memories of watching professional roller hockey. It was a big part of culture at the time. It was in movies and there was a Baywatch episode about roller hockey. I mean, you say that now and it sounds sort of, it's silly, but at the time it was a really big deal. And I had, you know, during COVID, a lot more free time, like many of us. And I started making connections with a lot of the old players and personnel that worked for the league. And through that was able to kind of put together, you know, a rough story. 3-4 years later, complete an entire production sort of tracing the origins of this, but also tracing what was left behind. And I think the larger theme here, and, you know, I let people interpret the film however they want to, because it's supposed to be a good time and you're supposed to feel nostalgic and get a couple laughs, hopefully. But the larger theme is more about, this was a time when programming, you know, on ESPN and was taking a lot more risk. You know, you could try things on TV. I mean, this was on TV for 3 years, which is insane. That's like a lifetime in today's landscape. And then also, you know, on the grassroots level, this was about giving people who don't come from traditional hockey backgrounds exposure to a new sport. So, you know, the kids and the families who might not be able to afford ice hockey, this was a way for them to see the sport and to get involved. And I think that was such an amazing era where we saw a ton of growth for hockey in California, on the ice, off the ice. And a lot of it came from this silly roller hockey league that took place in the late 90s.
Not to throw a spoiler out there, but what happened to it?
Look, I think a lot of factors. One was, you just saw the sale of rollerblades really drop off in the late 90s, and skateboarding got really big again. I think that played a factor into it. I also think, you know, television programming was changing. This was a time when ESPN was programming really experimental stuff. I mean, they had like the outdoor games, they had the X games. It was originally, you know, they were programming a lot of surfing on ESPN as well. So you're there, like I said, they were taking a lot of chances on the programming. This was one of the things. And ultimately, the sponsorship dollars, I think, after the third season were not lining up with the cost to produce this. But, you know, again, I think it's amazing that this was on TV for 3 years. I mean, on broadcast television, on ESPN. I think it's just incredible. And, you know, certainly left behind kind of a lot of mystery. And that's what the film goes into.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, when you think about how much sponsorship dollars matter then and now. Mm-hmm. And not that that's a big revelation, it certainly is not, but, you know, whereas something like the X game or extreme sports more broadly just kept growing and growing and growing. And I immediately think of Red Bull.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
With that, right?
You go back and you can watch the, you know, clips, and you can see all these sponsors that were involved. I mean, they had like Powerade and Sam Adams and Levi's. I mean, these were like major companies.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was, and credit to the founder, Dave McLean. I mean, that was the whole model, was getting these brands to kind of align with like the beach lifestyle. And like, that was really a league that was funded by these sponsorships and, you know, kind of a unique model.
So let's go back to 2020 or so when you started working on this as a filmmaker. So you're thinking back to your days as a young kid in Los Angeles, your dad bringing you probably what, Manhattan Beach or Hermosa Beach?
Yeah, so the league itself took place in Huntington Beach, but a lot of the guys like lived in Manhattan Beach, Hermosa Beach, and would like play in parking lots and would play locally. And like, you know, the hockey community in LA was like kind of a bubble. I mean, we were neighbors with some of the guys that played professionally, which is crazy. And then fast forward 25 years, and I was just shocked that this story hadn't been done. There was very little footage available, which to me was more of an exciting opportunity rather than a hurdle. I just saw that as, oh, this could be a chance to do something. And then, you know, committed the next 4 years of my life to doing it.
Now, you got Jeannie Buss from the people in Orr from the Los Angeles Lakers. How did you get Jeannie Buss on as an executive producer?
It's still crazy to this day that that happened. And yeah, sometimes I have to pinch myself. But I originally, when I was doing a lot of research for this project, people continually told me, you need to get a hold of Jeannie. She's really important to this story. She's really passionate about roller hockey. You got to interview her. Eventually, she either just called me outright or I finally got an email back. It was just very surreal. Because she owned the first ever professional roller hockey team in Los Angeles. This is way before she was working with the Lakers. Her dad really gave her an opportunity to run a different franchise before she ran the Lakers. And that was the LA Blades. So she's really passionate about roller hockey. I wanted to do an interview with her. And to my surprise, she actually just wanted to sit down and have lunch and talk about the project as a whole. That went pretty well, I think, because we ended up being partners and she wanted to be involved in more than just an on-camera presence. So just extremely grateful to this day to be able to work with her. And she really is a champion of the sport. And I don't think people realize like how much of a hockey fan she is. And I think it's just, this is a great opportunity to show people that.
So you've got the idea. Obviously, you're tracking down the guys who played mm-hmm. and the men and women who were involved in the sport. You're tracking down the footage. Jeannie Buss is willing to become an actual business partner on this film. So this is all sounding really good, and you spend the next 4 years putting this together. Fill me in, though, on the business model of actually trying to, you know, turn this film into something that is distributed, that is profitable.
Yeah, I mean, it is... And in the simplest sense, it is just like running a business. Like that is something that I think when I got started, I was maybe a little naive, but I think that ended up being a good thing about like you're running a business. I mean, I have, you know, an LLC and spreadsheets and all this not sexy stuff that people don't tell you about being a filmmaker.
That's not so Hollywood, Jake.
No, it's not at all. So, I mean, you're running a business and I have other partners as well that invested in the film. And there's different models you can set up your film LLC as, but you know, ours is pretty simple and straightforward, and everyone has a chunk of equity. And then, you know, the theory is that when this film is acquired down the road, we'll be able to pay out investors and, you know, again, fingers crossed, but it's set up much just like any startup really, if you will. And, you know, I should also give credit here. I have my two other partners, Max McCormick and Chris Drieger, were NHL players at the time. Chris recently left Winnipeg to play in the KHL, and Max is the captain for the Coachella Valley Firebirds. But they were instrumental in getting this project off the ground as well, and really just put their kind of faith in me to go run with this. So huge shout out to my producers.
The market has changed, right, in the last 4 years. I mean, beginning of COVID, everybody's home, and I know the streamers were looking for content. So, I mean, for you, for others out there trying to do this, what is the marketplace actually like now?
You know, it's funny because this conversation could change in weeks, but I think it's no secret that like streaming has really consolidated over the past year or two. I mean, there was, as you mentioned, a massive boom during COVID, and now there's been a really big pullback. And some of that's motivated, you know, financially by some of the companies and stock prices, but it's also, I think, motivated just by there was probably an oversaturation of documentary content that kind of came out during those COVID years. You could argue it was sort of a golden age of streaming documentaries, you know, Tiger King and Last Dance. And so there was a lot of influx of content that came in then. And I think we're definitely in a pullback now. I think sports content will always be relevant because you have a built-in fan base. But I just think it's the bar for getting things made and acquired right now is really, really, really high. And obviously it helps if you have, you know, Steph Curry or Serena Williams on, you know, which we don't. But I also think I wouldn't say that to dissuade people from going out and telling these stories, because if it's something you believe in and you're passionate about, you can find an audience for it. And that's kind of what we've done, is more of a grassroots approach and using social media and doing screening events like here in Buffalo to just build a community and show that like, hey, there's an audience for this. Believe it or not, people remember this.
On that note too, it feels to me like there's a little bit of a 90s, maybe more than a little bit of a 90s boom right now. And
right.
This is going to be the loosest possible connection. But, you know, as you and I sit here today, the Backstreet Boys are selling out show after show at the Sphere in Las Vegas, right? And, you know, I could go on and on. I mean, but 90s, early 2000s nostalgia, generationally, it seems like it's come back around. I don't know, does that play into your thinking on this piece?
Oh, yeah. That was one of our, you know, when we pitched this, we're like, hey, look at all these things that are popular once again. And like, we really tried to lean into the cultural aspects of the 90s in the film too, because it's just so fun to like use those bright colors and the music. And
yeah, and it is fun for people out there listening. If they want to see the film, they got to catch a screening right now.
Yeah, for now. I mean, I think, look, we can, you know, jump into the business side more, but for now, yes. But I would also recommend follow us on Instagram at ProBeachHockey. We also have a newsletter where, like, if we're doing a screening, we'll blast out a schedule. And, you know, the goal is right now, continue to do events, get people excited. We're bound to do a trip to Canada and to New York and Boston. So this will be on streaming eventually, but just stick with us.
Yeah, you got some good markets out there if people want to get in touch with you for a screening. There's there's some real possibility there. All right, let's broaden it out and go back in time just a little bit. You've been at this for about a decade now, you know, in this business, mm-hmm. right, as a filmmaker, as a digital media storyteller. Take people back a little and just tell us about the work you're doing at Bleacher Report, at MLB. A lot of it's right in front of me here. I've seen a lot of it, so I'll throw some specifics at you too.
Thanks. Yeah, right out of college, I got a job. I mean, I was a communications major, so it took a long time to get a job, to be honest. It's not, they don't just hand jobs to communications.
No, you know, that, you know, it's funny. Like, sorry to interject, but yeah, I tell communications majors, like, man, you could do anything, and that's both a blessing and a real curse.
Yeah, you have to work really hard to, like, to get that first job in I was like a, you know, communications film person, and meanwhile my finance and engineering friends already have jobs, like, you know, I certainly didn't. But eventually I got a production assistant job with Bleacher Report, and what was funny was that job was in New York City, and I think they thought that I lived in, like, accessible by train to New York City, right. And I was living with my parents in Buffalo, so I just showed up on Tuesday, like, without an apartment, and, like, they were like, can you make it in, because they needed someone for the NFL season. So I just showed up, and they were like, oh, like, did you take the train? And I'm like, no, I flew. So that really, I think, endeared myself to them. So I mean, eventually I settled in there. But and Bleacher Report is, I mean, that's, at the time they were like a startup doing a ton of, I mean, huge social media publisher. We're doing a lot of live content, like Facebook Lives used to be a really big deal, if you remember that. We were doing, you know, running fantasy football show, doing a lot of, you know, player interviews, things like that. It was just sort of a foundational experience in production. And then, you know, getting to work with talent was great too. Like, I worked with Chris Sims, Adam Lefko, my good friend Steven Nelson, who's the voice of the Dodgers now. Like, it was really cool to be on the ground floor of that, because so many people have came out of that to do amazing things in sports.
You went on to Major League Baseball. There are so many people I know, their dream is to work for MLB or the NFL, NHL, NBA, WNBA. They want to work for the big leagues. And you made it to the big leagues pretty quickly. So how did you come to MLB?
Yeah, I was at Bleacher Report for like 3-4 years. And I mean, look, they were owned by Turner and still are. Now they're owned by Warner Brothers. But their focus was really NBA and NFL heavy. And they obviously had the NBA rights package. You know, like, I felt like I could do a lot more, add a lot more value to maybe working in the baseball or the hockey space where there was a lot more room to grow digitally online. Like, the NBA had such a big footprint online, and like, you post a LeBron dunk and it gets, you know, 6 million views, and then, you know, so I felt like we could do a lot more with baseball. So they hired me as really their first, like, internal video team hire as a producer, and the whole mission there was just growing baseball for younger audiences. Specifically, my role was YouTube, you know, player storytelling. We did some great explainer series that I'm really proud of. We did mini documentaries, things like that really tried to grow the game off the field. And it was a blast. And I think they've done a really great job since I've left to, you know, continue trying to resonate with younger fans. I mean, the rule changes have definitely helped, but like, making baseball cool again, I think that was the bottom line, you know?
How do you take a sport that is slower and make it exciting in short form mm-hmm. videos for a young audience?
Yeah, I mean, that was the challenge. But I think the great thing about baseball is like, the nuance and the history. There's so much around ballpark and food and jerseys and hats, and there's just so much like rich history there that I think, like, when we work there, we're not asking you to sit in your seat for 9 innings and be dialed in on every pitch, right? Like, we're asking you to walk around and go get a beer and try the crazy food concoction or try the grasshoppers in Seattle, whatever, right? So we're not asking you to have this experience that happens every Sunday in the NFL. We were just asking fans to, like, be curious about the game and the things around the game, the stadiums and the culture. You know, baseball is such a big part of American culture. So people, it's easy to look at baseball and say it's boring or it's slow, but there's just so many nuances and beauty to the sport that's what we really try to, like, lean into. And as a storyteller, like, I got to do a lot of the off the field stuff, a lot of, like, you know, lore and history from the 150 years of baseball. That's really fun to explore too. And you can tell a lot of, like, funny stories about that stuff to make it, you know, resonate.
Yeah, there's a lot of nostalgia and great aesthetics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You can tap into.
Yeah.
How important are the celebrity connections too? If people visit your website, they'll immediately, you know, find an Aubrey Plaza celebrity sluggers video. But yeah, I mean, as a digital storyteller, are you tapping into those celebrity connections?
Well, that was a huge initiative at MLB. It was like, there are so many celebrity baseball fans out there. I mean, they've worked with, you know, rappers. They worked with Bryan Cranston. I think their latest campaign was with Adam Devine. Like, there's so many celebrity baseball fans, and we needed to find a way to get that that message across. And that was a huge priority. And yeah, I got to work with Aubrey Plaza and Big Boy from Outkast. That was really cool. They were both amazing. But we want, you know, to find ways to generate, to connect with the next generation. And that was one of them for sure.
Now, eventually you made a decision to forge out on your own, right? And stay out on your own and do what you're doing now, work as an independent filmmaker. So what does that look like, you know, to be doing this in LA, you know, without that regular, like, league affiliated paycheck coming in?
It's challenging for sure. You know, it was sort of just a leap of faith, but once we had Genie on board, I felt like I needed to commit myself to doing this and make this my number one priority. And so that was kind of a no-brainer, to be honest. And I had loved working at baseball, but I had been there about 4 or 5 years. So I was just really excited to pursue this, take all the things I learned there and then at Bleacher Report as well, take those things and then do a project on my own and not have to answer to anyone, which was amazing, you know, like, and frightening to be making all of the decisions. But I wanted to do that and to really just challenge myself. You know, to be candid, you do things along the way to pay the bills and you find editing jobs or producing jobs and you just try to, like, make it work from a, you know, keeping the lights on perspective. But, you know, I just felt like this was a great opportunity, and anyone in my shoes, if you got to be business partners with Genie and two NHL players, like, it just felt like something I needed to pursue with all of my attention.
What did you not realize about being an independent filmmaker until you actually took that step to become one?
Well, I would say, and this is just my kind of what I learned, is that you need to go into these things kind of with beginner's mind and not try to know everything on day one, or it's just going to be so overwhelming and daunting the amount of hurdles you have to face. So I think I did direct this documentary, but really the filming aspect of this only took, I don't know, like 8 or 9 months. And the rest of the time is like emails and spreadsheets and really stuff that's not sexy. I mean, and editing, I love editing too. And that was a highlight as well. But, you know, that took, you know, 6 to 8 months as well. So a lot of it is doing stuff, kind of the more gritty work that, you know, feels almost like an office job. That's the really hard stuff that you have to do if you want to get stuff off the ground, you know, bugging people to do interviews, right? Bugging people to try to find financing, bugging people to find distribution, right? So it's a lot of, like, a lot of emailing, a lot of following up. You know, I think there's definitely, like you said, there's a misconception that it's like this glamorous thing. And you're lucky if you get to do, you know, shooting on these projects, because that means you got it financed and you're making things. But that is a small portion of the work.
I'm thinking of a conversation I had the other day with a book agent. We were talking a bit about how AI has kind of infiltrated or infested, depending who's saying it, the publishing world, and I'm good with it. But, you know, same in the world of film, of course, and I know that's changing the landscape. And, you know, companies are scared, scared or hesitant, depending who we're talking about, to invest money, and that's on the book side. Are you finding that on the film side?
It's tough because you are running a business, but I also have to remind myself that, like, it's essentially an art project. I mean, yeah, there's money behind this, and we want to, you know, make our investors whole. But this is we're telling a story. It's a piece of art. At the end of the day, I'm not answering to a brand or a corporation who gets to make editorial decisions. So this is really, it's an artistic endeavor. At any time you're going to do a project like that, it's very tough from a financial standpoint, but we can only hope that, like, you know, I don't know. I don't have a ton of, like, optimism about AI surrounding film, to be honest. And I think it's going to be a challenge, but I think there's always going to be opportunities for great stories, always going to be opportunities for people who want to be involved in them financially to get them done. I just have to believe that, or else like I got to be optimistic about it because this is the world that I live in. So
I should tell you too, that same book agent was saying to me, you know, sports though is always the safe bet.
Sports is kind of the last sort of thing we have to watch live, right? I mean, we can even, you know, we can watch full concerts on YouTube now. So it's like sports is kind of the last thing you have to watch live, and that's keeping cable broadcast alive, right? There will always be a need for whether it's sports content or sports adjacent. Absolutely.
I want to jump around a little bit here and ask, I'm going to ask you about a few different sports that I know you're going to have some knowledge on. So you said at the beginning of the conversation, you know, and any of us old enough to remember it will know it, you know, how big rollerblading inline skates were back in the 90s, the early 2000s. And then that kind of filtered down, maybe not away, but down in favor of skateboarding, mm-hmm. which made a comeback.
Oh, yeah.
Right? This is anecdotal, but I I absolutely have seen more people on roller skates, you know, the kind with four wheels.
No, we accept lately. The roller skaters too.
You know. But just in terms of, I'm curious, because you spend time, you live on the West Coast, you spend time on the East Coast. As you travel the country, what are you seeing in terms of participation and, you know, openness to these different sports that involve, you know, putting your feet on wheels?
Roller hockey is pretty regional, right? I think Southern California is still the hotbed of roller hockey. But there are communities, like I know St. Louis has a big roller hockey community. And that's where Pat Maroon is from, and he's a big roller hockey player. You know, I think New York City has a pretty big roller hockey community. I've done a little bit of like grassroots outreach to organizations in Buffalo where they have roller hockey. So, you know, I think the big factor is like the weather. Like in Florida, they have a lot of roller hockey too, because you can play year round. If they choose to pursue ice hockey because they love playing on wheels, then that's amazing. But for some people that just want to play outside and play at a much cheaper price point, I think roller hockey is a great alternative.
I want to ask you about an entirely different sport on wheels. We're sitting here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, and I know a handful of years ago, you worked with this organization to make a film that tells the story of wheelchair football. Tell us about that.
This was probably 2021, 22. I was back in East Aurora, and I ran into my old high school football coach at Borderland Music Festival, of all places. I thought he was retired from coaching football, but as it turned out, he was coaching wheelchair football. And I was just so curious. I just think I'd heard of it. I knew adaptive sports. We knew sled hockey's big here, but never heard of wheelchair football. And this was actually happening kind of during the early stages of pro beach hockey. And this allowed me to like step away from a little. I think sometimes when you're in a creative project, like it's nice to step away and do something else. And then you can come back with like a new energy. So I kind of took a little break from the roller hockey project and worked with Coach Wade and the Buffalo Adaptive Football team to tell their story as they competed in their first ever tournament in Kansas City. And they didn't win any games, but that wasn't the point. Like, the point was all these amazing characters playing a brand new sport. Also just great athletes too. So it was amazing working with them, and still to this day support, you know, all their initiatives.
Whether it's that piece, the beach roller hockey piece, what kind of thought process do you go through to find a story arc?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's the characters. It's like all about, are these interesting people with dynamic personalities and that have, you know, willingness to be in front of the camera and be themselves? And like that resonated right away with wheelchair football, because I went to one of these practices and I just saw these amazing personalities, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, I mean, that's what drives a documentary, is like if you have big real people expressing themselves, that's the recipe, you know, for a good story. That was easy for wheelchair football because they were leading up to a tournament. So it was sort of like, for me, when I look at stories, it's like we need big personalities and we need like a payoff for the audience. We need something that gets them, that keeps them around. And for wheelchair football, it was for sure this tournament. And it was a little more challenging for pro beach hockey because we were talking about an archival project that was 25 years ago. But we were able to, I think, pay this off in a way that it's rewarding. But that's a lot harder to do with like an archival project.
It's I'll resist the urge to give anything away either. But for folks out there who have an opportunity to see it, do it and you'll see it. It was thoughtful. It was heartfelt. It's clever. You have anything else in the works right now? Or are you 100% on?
Oh, I mean, I'm always pitching ideas and getting ideas in front of people. That's kind of what I do on the day-to-day basis, is what's the next big project I can commit myself to? And that's a really challenging process. I think there's a lot of hesitancy, like we talked about, in kind of the marketplace right now. You're seeing, you know, the occasional Sundance documentary that doesn't get distribution, and it's just really challenging. But I'm just trying to look at projects that I get really excited about.
Yeah, that I have a good friend who often says, you know, teenagers are the world's greatest untapped resource, and the reason for it speaks to what you're saying. They're young enough to not put limits on themselves, and they're just old enough to have big ideas that they can start to pursue.
But I'm always pitching ideas in the sports world, and it's only a matter of time before something clicks, because this is what I like doing. But you know, it takes a lot out of you, so you want to make sure that, you know, you're passionate about it. I can't just latch on to anything because I know how difficult it is from beginning to end.
And hey, Jake, on that note about passion, and I'm going to go back to my previous point too about younger people, about teenagers. I'm certain there will be people out there listening to this who either would say, I would love to do what he does, or say, I have a kid, a niece, a nephew, someone in my life who is great with a camera, who loves to sit and edit, who loves sports, who's a great storyteller, some mix of those traits. What would you tell those people, and how would somebody really know whether they want to commit to doing this, becoming a filmmaker?
That's a great question. For me, it's like when an idea keeps you up at night and then you wake up in the morning and you're still thinking about that idea, that's when it clicks and you're like, I have to do this. For me, it's that simple. It's like, if I'm thinking about this all the time, you have to pursue it.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. That's when you know, and that's when it starts to become a big part of your life.
Hey, Jake, this has been a real pleasure. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Thanks for joining me on Skin in the Game.
Thanks, Tim. Really appreciate it.
All right. We'll be back with a wrap right after this. You're listening to Skin in the Game.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places, it can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From your morning commute to quiet evenings at home, Buffalo Toronto Public Media is always there with trusted news, inspiring stories, and timeless music. It's your connection to a world of wonder. This is Public Media.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Skin in the Game. Jake Simperman has stepped out of the studio and has been replaced by John Simperman. John, we'll take you. Yes. Jake was a lot of fun, but yes. I'll take you back.
You now have the less talented Simperman in the room. You know, it's very humbling to listen in and, you know, obviously super proud of everything he has done and continues to do. So I wanted to thank you for the idea to bring him in studio, and hopefully our listeners enjoyed the conversation as much as I did.
And as much as I did. He's one of the first people I asked you about getting on the show. So Jake, who lives in Los Angeles, is here in New York State tonight for a film screening, and I'm glad we had the opportunity. So I'm going to actually pull you, though, John, out of dad role and into sports marketer role, and ask you a question about roller hockey, which, you know, as Jake described, we don't see too much of anymore. Regionally, there are pockets of it. You know, back about 25 years ago, it was a pretty big thing, at least a widely broadcast thing for, you know, for at least a short amount of time.
Sure.
And back at that same time, you were running marketing for the Los Angeles Kings. I am thinking about the NFL using flag football as a way to pull people into the sport of football. And I know the parallel here is not precise, but were you able to use roller hockey to try to build more hockey fans, recruit more hockey, more young people into the sport of hockey back in Los Angeles?
Absolutely. And I would just, going back into the memory banks here, roller hockey, roller blading were really the cornerstone of our marketing plan back then. I mean, we had a bigger, big partnership. You may remember the brand Mission Hockey, but Mission Hockey was the producer of sticks and skates and helmets. They were roller hockey. And we formed a major partnership with them. And we even had this, what we branded as the King's Chariot, where we brought out boards and sticks and skates and brought roller hockey into the communities, many times more so underprivileged communities, and to get sticks in hands. That was our marketing motto back in LA when no one knew the difference between a football and a hockey puck, was get sticks in hand. And roller hockey was that bridge because, A, we could bring the equipment very accessibly out to the kids in a parking lot. And then, you know, B, it was just a chance to introduce them to the sport. If you go out to an LA Kings game today, it is probably one of the most diverse fan bases. And a lot of that, I will go back to those early days, bringing the roller hockey out to the communities and getting sticks, and in this case, skates on the feet of kids.
Well, it's interesting to see what different sports do to make that game available to kids. I mean, you're describing a way that works in hockey, flag football. Heck, we had Scott Swinson on from the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation, you know, recently, and he mentioned something that I'm really intrigued by, which is a form of baseball called quickball, which can be done inside or outside, and it's just an adapted form of baseball.
Right. Exactly the same. And you brought up kind of the importance and the relevancy of roller hockey in the late 90s in LA, you know, not only on building a fan base, but I would also argue building a generation of hockey players. If you look at the number of NHL players today, and even over the last 10 years, that started their hockey career in either Southern California or, in the case of Austin Matthews, in Arizona, I'd venture to guess their first skates or their first introduction to hockey was on rollerblades. And I just, you know, look at the growth of hockey in the state of California and now all the players being drafted. Yeah, Gretzky helped as well, but so did roller hockey.
Yeah, and Jake's film does a great job, actually, of, you know, conveying the power of Wayne Gretzky, too. So I keep teasing it for people out there to, you know, get a screening in their city and come watch it. But he did an incredible job. John, I do want to ask you a question about digital storytelling. So your son, Jake, is a documentarian, a filmmaker. But before that, before he was doing that full time, he was working for Major League Baseball and doing short form videos as, you know, ultimately as a way of marketing the sport. My question for you as a marketing guy is, how important is that digital storytelling nowadays and going forward?
Well, I think in sports like baseball and sports like hockey, it's even more important because, you know, they need to show the personalities of the players. If you look at hockey players, they're very conservative in how they put themselves out there, right? We've talked to a few of our guests on Skin in the Game about how hockey, their culture isn't about me, it's about team. So it's really tough to get them out of their shell. And the same thing with baseball. There's a lot of great personalities in a lot of smaller markets, and these digital platforms, you know, give some personality and fun to the game. So I would think when it comes to baseball and in hockey in particular, having that form of communications is really important just to get the personalities and the unique characters, you know, out there.
I was at the Tribeca Film Festival in June in New York City and sat in on a session with the Kansas City Chiefs executive who is now in charge of their media arm. They started a studio called, I believe it's Foolish Club Media or Foolish Club Studios. Foolish Club referring to the AFL when the Bills and the Chiefs were founded back in 1959, 1960. But they're going to be doing more long-form projects, I think, as well. I mean, can you see more teams, more leagues getting into long-form projects versus, you know, those short, quick TikTok style snippet type pieces?
Yeah, I think so. And you see a lot of teams now investing in their own regional sports networks, right? Started with the Yankees in New York State. You know, I think there's going to be a time where you're buying potentially content, or in this case, games, directly from the club and not from a cable subscription or a Netflix or an Amazon. So teams and organizations are doing everything they can to hold on and monetize their content.
There was a great piece in the New York Times maybe a month ago or so where the writer said, I'd have to look back at the number, but I've paid just under $5,000 a year to be a sports fan. It was like $4,800 something for all the streaming services, all the pay-per-views, things like that. So.
Absolutely. And then if they can bundle a 30-minute show into that, it's just adding more revenue back to the club. So yeah, I think, Tim, to that point, you're going to see more sports organizations build those internal content departments and look for ways to monetize it beyond just putting it up on the Jumbotron during the game.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked Jake. I mean, if you're a young person or you have a young person in your life who loves sports, loves storytelling, and what would you advise that young person to do?
Well, you know, first of all, follow the passion. That's number one, right? If you want to work in sports, that's great, but don't limit yourself to sports. Sports is entertainment, so you can broaden that out, right? And, you know, focus on storytelling around music or other entertainment. So don't put yourself in a box. Follow the passion. And then, sure, I think the advice to anyone who's young and trying to break in is find some backyard project and film it and edit it and kind of start getting yourself out there.
What project do you want to see Jake do next?
Oh, boy. Maybe it's going to be a documentary on skin in the game, Tim. What do you think?
Oh, it could be. It could be. I feel like I'm interviewing you here, and I think we I drove you to the answer I want to hear.
No, there's so many awesome untold stories out there. You know, selfishly, what I love about, you know, the roller hockey documentary is, you know, to me, it's got a kind of a 30 for 30 vibe to it. And you're always like, oh, yeah, what happened to that? And there's hundreds of stories about the story of the Buffalo Braves, what happened to them and why'd they go away. And, you know, think about all those lost franchises, right? So I think there's so many cool stories, and retro is still in. So I think there's plenty of potential opportunities out there.
Yeah, sports is absolutely a window into everything. And that's why we're here on Skin in the Game. John, thanks for ceding the studio to me today. It was a pleasure to talk to Jake. It's good to have you back in that seat.
Thanks for bringing him in. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. Tim and I talk a lot about past broadcasts and past episodes. But yeah, feel free to go back on any of the archives and any of your podcast platforms and tune into past episodes of Skin in the Game.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
And remember, you know, whether you're a fan of a team or a fan of sports, or just a resident of this region, we all have skin in the game. This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.